This is Franklin Jacoby, and welcome to the ICE at Dartmouth podcast. Today we are going to talk about the mind, consciousness, and the relationship between the mind and the body. Questions such as what is the mind, what is consciousness, and how are mental phenomena related to the body have perplexed and inspired philosophers and scientists for millennia. Even though these are some very old problems, new and fascinating research challenges us to think about our mental lives differently and perhaps more deeply. I'm going to talk with Dr. Evan Thompson about his distinctive approach to the study of mental phenomena, which draws on a number of different fields and systems of thought. Evan is professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver and an associate member of the Department of Asian Studies and the Department of Psychology. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and has written extensively about the mind in books and articles. Thanks very much, Evan, for taking the time to chat with me. You work on philosophy of mind, cognitive science, and it seems to me from your work that a big part of what you're working on is addressing what we might call the mind-body problem. That's a fair characterization of it. And I wonder if you want to say a little bit about how you think of that problem, why it's such a difficult problem.
Yeah, so I work on issues having to do with the mind and the self and consciousness and cognition. And I do that from different perspectives that I try to weave together. My principal institutional home and training is in philosophy. So I think of myself as primarily a philosopher, but I work in the field of cognitive science, of which philosophy is a constituent discipline. So that's the interdisciplinary scientific study of the mind, integrating philosophy and neuroscience and psychology. And I also have, my undergraduate training was in Asian studies, in Chinese language and history and Asian philosophical traditions. So I try to bring the perspectives of Asian philosophy, particularly Indian or South Asian philosophical traditions and Chinese philosophy, into addressing questions about the mind and the self and consciousness. Specifically with regard to the mind-body problem, the approach that I take is one that tries to weave together an investigation of the mind from the perspective of human experience. So in philosophical terms, this would be called phenomenology, the study of experience from from within experience, you could say. So that involves trying to describe different modes of experience like dreaming, waking, attentive perception, mind wandering, different modes of experience to describe them experientially using philosophical and psychological concepts. And then I try to weave that together. I should say that in doing that, I also try to draw from rich traditions of examining experience in Asian philosophy. So for example, in Indian philosophy, there's, you know, very interesting discussions of sleeping and dreaming in relationship to waking consciousness. And so I try to integrate that then with investigations of cognitive processes and the brain from the perspectives of cognitive psychology and cognitive neuroscience. And I'm particularly interested in the idea there of enriching our understanding of experience through the neuroscientific perspective and then enriching our understanding of the brain and the body by bringing the phenomenological perspective to bear on questions having to do with cognitive function and the brain. So that's in very general terms how I see. I suppose that's in a way a kind of methodological answer to the question. That is, there is this mind-body problem which, you know, different traditions have been occupied with for millennia, really. And so that's how I approach that problem methodologically, you could say, by trying to integrate these different perspectives.
Excellent. For a few hundred years anyway, there seems to be a bit of a tension between, in many thinkers, in approaching the methods through experience or phenomenology and approaching it through a study of the brain or through neurons or that sort of, you might think of as laboratory science. What do you think about that tension? That doesn't seem to be something that's holding you back from the way you're approaching the problem.
Yeah, I think the two are inseparable and fundamentally important, and that you can't really do one properly without the other. They're needed to calibrate each other, correct each other. So, of course, if you approach the brain as a biologist and you're interested in it as a biological or physiological system, that's fine. But the minute you ask any question about, how does such a system support or enable cognition or perception or attention or feeling or awareness, then right away you're in the land of philosophical and phenomenological and psychological concepts. And so you need to have some understanding of them and some precision in how you use them. And that's not going to come straightforwardly out of, measuring neuronal activity, for example. Conversely, if you raise questions about perception, perceptual experience, and you investigate them purely experientially, there are many interesting things you can say, but then you're not going to be able to relate what you say and revise what you say in light of an understanding of the body, of the living and lived body that is the locus and the support for those processes. So it's true that these things have been in tension historically at different times. But I see that as really arising from biases and emphases that aren't particularly productive for research. And I think if you look at in the history of science or in the history of philosophy, particular individuals who are, very gripped by questions of mind and life, you're going to find these perspectives intersecting in those individuals' thought, whether they're scientists or whether they're philosophers. So I think, some of the tension between them can be creative, but the idea that they're opposed to each other or that one should supplant the other doesn't seem to me to really make much sense.
So one way, take it your way of approaching this problem is through something called embodied cognition, mm-hmm. which is a relative, as far as these issues go, is a relatively recent term. Do you want to say a little bit about what embodied cognition is?
Yeah, so the term embodied cognition has arisen within, say, the past 30 years or so within the field of cognitive science to emphasize the idea that when we're studying cognition or perception or mind more generally, the proper unit of analysis is the whole animal, embodied animal or person embedded in an environment and interacting with the environment, and that rather than thinking of, say, cognition as something that happens inside the brain, we should conceive of it as something that happens in the relation between the organism or the animal or the person, the embodied individual, and the environment. So an analogy that I like to use to help people understand what I mean is, if you take flight, it would be a kind of category mistake or confusion to say that flight is inside the wings of the bird. Rather, the bird has wings. Wings enable lift, which enables flight, but flying is something that is a relation between the bird and the environment. So similarly, the basic idea behind the embodied approach is that cognition is not something inside the brain. It's rather a relation between the animal and its environment, and that relation is manifested in perception and action, just as flying is a relationship between the bird and the environment. So you need wings to fly, you need a brain to think, you need a brain to perceive, but the thinking isn't inside the brain, it's rather in the embodied individual. And then from the embodied perspective, the research question is, how to characterize that relation in a way that brings out the fundamental importance of the structure, the bodily structure of the kind of cognitive being that we're talking about. The one other thing I would say is that although I just gave you a kind of, thumbnail sketch of the idea of embodied cognition in cognitive science, it's an older idea in the philosophical tradition of phenomenology. And by that, I mean coming from the work of Edmund Husserl in German philosophy, and then the development of it, especially by Maurice Merleau-Ponty in the French phenomenological tradition. His philosophy is a philosophy of what he calls the lived body, the body of lived experience. And that idea, which he was very concerned, Merleau-Ponty, to relate to the neuropsychology and neurology of his time in the 40s and 50s and 60s, that idea is the sort of deeper philosophical backdrop to embodied cognition and cognitive science.
Now, the consequence of this view, would you say, is that the mind or mentality is then a kind of a process or something that emerges from that reaction between body and environment?
Yeah, I would say that that mind or cognition is a process. It's a process that consists in the relationship between the activity of the organism or animal or person in their in and with their environment, which in the case of the human being is, of course, a social and cultural environment. So that's, you know, fundamental for understanding the kind of cognition that we human beings have, and other animals as well, of course, are social animals, mammals especially. You could say that cognition, I mean, one way to put it is that, you know, cognition isn't a thing. It's not a routine inside the head. It's an activity that's enacted in a suite of processes that are inherently relational.
How does this relate, do you think, to a more materialist approach to the mind? I'm thinking of materialism as the idea that you could provide a complete or at least a very satisfactory account of the mind using only physical or material kinds of explanations.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the issue with a question like that is partly what we mean by physical or material. So nothing that I've said so far would imply that we need to invoke concepts that aren't, you could say, natural or naturalistic in the sense that we can make them intelligible through science. It's not a reductionistic viewpoint in the sense that the idea isn't that you can replace a phenomenological or a psychological description with, say, a purely biochemical description, or that you could even replace it with a purely information processing computational description. So if, you know, physicalist or materialist means reductionist in that sense, it's not reductionist in that sense. I would say that the heart of the matter really for me is that when we're studying especially consciousness, so the lived, you know, experience or the felt experience of awareness, there's a sense in which that has a kind of primacy in our knowledge, because when we're doing science, we're relying on consciousness. We're relying on our capacities of observation, on our capacities of understanding each other, communicating in communities of observing investigators, and all of that depends on human consciousness. So the idea that you could somehow step outside of, you know, human consciousness, get around it, outside it, behind it, and say, and sort of see it from an outside perspective, kind of like sideways on, up against something else, as it were, and say, well, it's just a physical process. That doesn't really make sense to me, because consciousness has this irreducible primacy in our knowledge. But that doesn't, there's nothing sort of mysterious about that in the sense that, or let me put it this way, you know, that the task is to understand nature as itself making possible that kind of primacy of consciousness, rather than trying to reduce consciousness to nature considered in a way that has, as it were, just sort of siphoned off all the consciousness out of it. That's a kind of complicated answer, because it sort of it depends on what, you know, physical material means in these discussions.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I guess you could think about it in terms of as explanation, and then also maybe in terms of ontology. Is there anything distinctive about the existence of mentality as opposed to physical phenomena? Is it just a kind of physical phenomenon amongst mm-hmm. many? I have a sense of where you would stand on the explanation level. What would you say about that right, sort of existence? Right.
So there, I think it's very difficult to think about properly, because immediately in the terms that we use and the way that we describe the situation, as indeed you just did, we set up a conceptual contrast between just the physical and then consciousness. So we're thinking, well, whatever the physical is fundamentally, it's not consciousness. And whatever consciousness is fundamentally, it doesn't reveal anything of its physical, you know, embodiment or instantiation. And so we're operating already in a dualistic problem space of concepts that, you know, we're getting from in Western philosophy, we're getting from Descartes most immediately, but from the rise of modern physical science in general. And so I think that, and that gives us, you know, what in the philosophy of mind context we call the so-called explanatory gap, that, you know, no matter what you say about the brain and the complexity of its workings, there always seems to be this further question about, well, why is consciousness occurring, this gap between the physical description and then the description in terms of what philosophers call phenomenal concepts that have to do with conscious experience. So when you have it set up that way, then you're kind of stuck, I think. And I don't think there's really any way to move forward productively. So that's a negative point. To put it positively, I would say that I think that we have to, through philosophy and science, work our way towards a concept of nature in which the nature of nature is not to be fundamentally physical in a way that already excludes the mental. So we different philosophers have different ideas about how this is going to be done. So, you know, some think, well, let's make consciousness everywhere. The so-called panpsychist option is to say, well, consciousness is fundamental and it's everywhere. That's opposed to a kind of physicalist view that tries to get consciousness as a sort of emergent feature out of a certain kind of physical complexity. My own view again on that is that we in effect we need a revolution in our thinking about nature for that kind of problem to have any forward movement. And that's going to take a transformation in our understanding of science and in our understanding of experience. And I think that's going to come through pursuing phenomenology and science in tandem. But we're not there yet. So I'm not the kind of philosopher, I suppose, who likes to propose a sort of, like, I don't know how to put it, say, speculative metaphysical construction that's meant to solve this problem for us. I think it's going to require conceptual evolution that's just going to come from hard work, both in phenomenology and in science. I don't really see any other way. I think all the philosophical moves that philosophers currently make are still within a problem space that really makes the problem ultimately intractable.
How is it working? I mean, given that the science, many sciences perhaps have that sort of physicalism lean to them, how is it working with them when they're pre-revolution, you might say, before having a more appropriate set of concepts, say, to talk about the mind?
I'm not sure I understand the question exactly. Can you say a little bit more?
Yes, absolutely. So you say that, so since Descartes, we've got in many cases a kind of mind-body split, and certain sciences, I'm thinking, I suppose, of certain neurosciences, physics, that have a real materialist foundation. And yet you're trying to work with some of those very sciences with phenomenology. So there's a conceptual gap, you might say, between those different projects. So how do you go about bridging that conceptual gap between those more physical-based sciences and more experience-based investigations right. like phenomenology?
Okay, I see. Well, I would say that within the context of cognitive science, or let's say the scientific study of the mind more generally, the embodied approach is an important first step there, because what the embodied approach does is it says that when we are when we're characterizing cognition, either operationally or organizationally or functionally, and when we're characterizing consciousness experientially, the fundamental reference point is the body, the living and lived body. So rather than trying to close a gap between a mind, which is described in a purely kind of inward way that makes the body just sort of an accidental contingent feature of experience, rather than describing the mind that way and describing the body as if it's a purely physical system where it's an accidental contingent feature that it happens to be associated with mind, that the idea of the body already supersedes that conceptual dichotomy, because the body can't be understood as what it is unless it's understood as a living body and a lived body at the same time. Now, that doesn't close the gap, because there's, in a way, still a kind of gap between the body understood experientially and the body understood, let's say, organizationally or functionally. But the space between the terms is considerably reduced, so that if you you can relate the terms of the discussion much more closely. This, in my own work, this is especially something I explored in my book Mind and Life. In my own work, the idea there is really to see the body as a system that that creates itself structurally and functionally, and in doing so creates meaning for itself in relationship to the environment. So there's a individuation process that gives you the body as a stable, relatively stable dynamical system that is by the necessity of its organization engaged in a kind of sense making in relationship to its environment. So already when you're describing the body that way, you're closer to a description of the experience of the lived body in phenomenological terms. So as I say, it doesn't close the gap, because it's not as if you don't have things that, you know, still need to be bridged and sort of braided into each other, but you've reduced the distance considerably compared to the Cartesian, you know, mind versus body, which is still very much how I think a lot of the philosophy of consciousness is done in that more Cartesian framework.
Something like the body seems, I suppose, at first blush, like a fairly straightforward thing. But when you're in your work in Mind and Life, I suppose there you're thinking of it as a system with discrete parts. How would you characterize it further? Presumably not all parts of the body are equally relevant here for thinking about this system.
Right. So, I mean, I would say the body is a, from that perspective, is a complex differentiated system that doesn't have discrete parts, but has, differentiated capacities that are interrelated. And so, you know, loss always has to be compensated for through some kind of plastic reorganization. And, some are obviously especially crucial for overall physiological regulation, like the heart and the lungs and the brain. The more and more that we learn about these systems, the more interrelated it's apparent that they are. So, at a molecular level, the crosstalk between the immune, endocrine, and nervous systems, the dense interconnections between, the gut brain and the cortex, and how the gut brain and microbiota are crucial for affect and mood in relationship to, say, disorders like depression. So from my perspective, the more and more we learn about the body, the more complexly interrelated these systems are. Of course, some are more crucial for some kinds of capacities than other. It's not uniform. It's not equipotential by any means. There's always differentiation and specialization. But the emphasis in the embodied cognition perspective is very much on characterizing what's going on in let's say, network and process terms rather than modular, discrete system terms.
So we've talked a little bit about how cognitive science and phenomenology play in your work. How about your work with, I guess you might call it Asian studies, other other cultures with different conceptions of the mind? How do you feel that that helps and informs your work?
Right. So there, I would say first, just in very general terms, that if we're concerned to understand the mind, then relying on the concepts and terms of any one tradition and any one linguistic community is already, I would say, a deficient way to proceed, right? So just in general terms, it's very important, I think, to be aware of, say, for example, how in South Asian philosophical traditions, there's a very rich conceptual language for talking about cognition and perception and attention and what happens when you go from being awake to falling into sleep to dreaming. And what I try to do in my work is when I'm working on a specific topic, for example, the nature of attention or the nature of dreaming, is to take advantage of those different traditions of discussion. And I mean, to do so in a way that's responsible to those traditions. So, you know, they have a history and a context within which they're talking about what they're talking about, and they have their own motivations for being interested in what they're interested in. So you have to be aware of those, and you have to do justice to them so that you don't create this kind of like decontextualized mishmash. But in my work, for example, in my book, Waking, Dreaming, Being, I'm particularly interested in consciousness and the experience of the self as it shifts across states of attentive waking perception, mind wandering, falling asleep, dreaming, lucid dreaming, dreaming when you know you're dreaming, sleep when dreaming seems to dissolve, dreamless sleep, different kinds of states of meditative concentration or meditative awareness. And so I'm interested in kind of a full spectrum view of consciousness. And I draw heavily on Indian philosophical traditions that characterize consciousness in that full spectrum way. So they have a kind of full, you know, waking, dreaming, dreamless sleep, meditative absorption perspective. And that's the overall context within which they're looking at, for example, how we experience having or being a self. And so I try to draw from that and relate it to what we know in neuroscience and in psychology and in, you know, different lineages in Western philosophy. So that's, in general terms, that's what is coming to be called cross-cultural philosophy of mind or trans-cultural philosophy of mind. Sometimes it's called fusion philosophy, depending on, you know, whose preferred term you use. So that's how those traditions in general terms figure into my work.
And how is it I'm not sure what the correct term would be, but transposing those concepts and distinctions from those cultures and societies and practices to, I suppose, a Western academic setting, or at least a, you know, North American academic setting. Is there a challenge there? Is it one that you can mediate, or is it just something lurking in the background?
No, I'd say there's always a challenge. So you need, in working with other traditions, you need scholars of those traditions, both indigenous scholars especially, and then you know, people who have worked with indigenous scholars and studied the languages. And it's a little bit like if you're, you know, we think there is this thing called Western philosophy and that Aristotle belongs to the West. Well, I mean, in a way, but that's a kind of retrospective construct. And so if you're working on Greek philosophy, you need people who really know Greek, who are really specialists on Greek thinking, and you defer to them, and then you use, you know, the materials that they offer. Now, ancient Greece is a culture that is no more, but in the case of say, South Asian Indian Buddhist philosophy in the Pali language, or in the case of Tibetan philosophy or Chinese philosophical traditions, I mean, these are living traditions. So one has to work with indigenous scholars from those traditions who are looking at them both in historical terms, but also who are writing about issues of concern to us today from the perspective of those traditions. So it's a kind of conversation. It's, you know, you have to enter into a conversation. You have to have, you know, respect and toleration for different viewpoints. You have to familiarize yourself as much as possible. And it's always an ongoing thing. It's a shifting work in progress, and it requires a kind of openness to revision and a kind of sensitivity that that I think is, I mean, that's required for this field in any case, but that's a particular instance of it.
And I suppose the phenomenologists, or what we think of as the sort of continental phenomenologists, were informed by some of those traditions as well. Is that right?
A little bit. I mean, Husserl read about Buddhism based on the scholarship available to him at the time, which was, you know, not the greatest. He was very interested in it. I would say the sort of era of classical phenomenologists like Husserl, Sartre, Merleau-Ponty were not really so knowledgeable about these traditions. I would say for phenomenology today, that's not the case. So, for example, my colleague and friend in Copenhagen, Dan Zahavi, who directs the Center for Subjectivity Research there, he's a phenomenological philosopher, and he has sponsored meetings on, you know, phenomenology and Buddhist philosophy. We co-edited a book called Self, No Self with the Buddhist philosopher and scholar Mark Sideritz that's about issues of the reality or illusoriness of the self from the perspectives of Indian philosophy and phenomenology and analytical philosophy. So contemporary philosophers, especially the new generation of students and younger philosophers who are coming up, I think are much more adept at moving across these traditions than the generations, certainly even 15 years ago, and definitely, you know, like 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. Yeah, no question. So there is progress in that sense.
So rapid progress, a lot of change in a short period of time.
Right.
Yeah. What is, I mean, so what are some of the key questions you think are important when trying to study the self?
Well, I approach that question mainly through what are the different ways that we experience having or being a self, or the, you know, the sense of self. And as I said, I'm, you know, at least in my book, Waking Dreaming Being, I was especially interested in how the sense of self is something that shifts along with different modes of awareness in, you know, like absorbed waking activities versus, say, mind wandering and daydreaming, the sense of self that characterizes dreaming, or the sense of self and how that shifts when you become aware that you're dreaming. So that's was the particular perspective from which I approached that. So the questions there that I think are really crucial ones are ones about understanding what the self is in light of what it is to experience having or being a self. And the emphasis in my work was on how that's a kind of, that the self isn't a thing or an entity, it's a process, and it's a process that's under constant construction. And I used that perspective to counter a very, I would say, prevalent way of talking about the self that we see in our culture, which is to say that the self is an illusion, and it's an illusion created by how the brain works. And it's not as if that perspective is, you know, there's something to that perspective. The reason people say that, it is based on certain kinds of important insights about the self and experience and how the brain works. But it's an overstatement that assumes as a reference point that whatever a self would be, it would have to be a singular, persisting mental substance or entity. And when we look for such a thing, oh, we don't find it. We find just complex processes interrelated. And so the self either doesn't exist or it's an illusion. Whereas my approach is to say, well, we shouldn't really have started with that way of characterizing the self at the outset. And when we think of it in terms of what it means to experience having an individuality or having a sense of agency or having memory or having an awareness of the state that you're in, that I'm now awake or I'm now dreaming, that when we approach it from that perspective, we can characterize it as a kind of process under constant construction.
And now that way of thinking about the self as a process under constant construction, it seems on the face of it like it's in a bit of tension with maybe a naive or intuitive idea of the self as a kind of persisting individual constant thing. You described it nicely just a moment ago. I mean, how do you account for that, the fact that we might have that sort of naive conception, and how or why should we overcome that naive conception?
Right. So I think in part that naive conception is one that we inherit through a particular philosophical intellectual tradition, which, you know, we can trace from, you know, say Plato into Christianity, into Descartes, into, you know, modern thought that emphasizes a kind of self-standing, autonomous individual that would have to have a substantial being in itself. So there's a kind of intellectual heritage there. And that's where it's very important to look at other traditions and other ways of conceptualizing selfhood or personhood. That's part of it. And then I think there's also in our own, you could say, spontaneous experience in memory, especially where we're struck with various, you might say, perplexities or paradoxes, where it seems that, you know, I can recall a memory now of when I was 5 or 6 years old, and it presents as an experience that happened to me, that is the self I am now, was present back then in the past. I can recall that experience that attaches to me now. I can recognize that I am the one now remembering it. And so we, in our kind of evolving mental lives, we have the sense that, you know, that there is this enduring self through time. At the same time, when we sort of, you know, explore the memory and think about what's going on, I think it also becomes immediately apparent that, well, I'm not the same, that I'm recreating the memory now, that every time I recreate the memory, it's a recreation, it's something afresh given how I feel now. And so there's this perplexity we're confronted with within our experience. I seem to be the same, but I'm obviously different. And then, you know, we try to stabilize that or sort of ground it in a way that can lead into thinking or feeling, really more than thinking, actually feeling like there is this, you know, inner core that, like, if you peel away all the layers of the onion, then boom, there's the, you know, like the inside core that is the self. Experientially, I think that can be very, you know, compelling and gripping. At the same time, though, we also can see that it isn't really like that, that something else is happening. And so that's, I would say, I mean, that's a kind of phenomenological description of what leads people in to trying to figure out, well, what is a self anyway? What, you know, what is it exactly that we're moving around or orbiting or seem to be orbiting in experiences like that?
So would you say that that tradition from Plato to Descartes and modern and more modern views, is that then just a, maybe it's unkind to say mistaken view, but they've just chosen specific kinds of experiences as the primary experiences and are just misled into their characterization of the mind based on that narrow conception? And so we should think of other traditions as being better, more correct for not being so narrowly selective.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in the case of that particular narrative, I think there are experiences that are powerful that are motivating what's going on. So an experience, an apparent experience of a purely self-reflective, conscious subjectivity that has a kind of, I mean, it's always embedded in a normative frame too, because in, you know, a Platonic context, it has a kind of purity that the body doesn't have. And that gets taken up in Christianity in relationship to thinking about the soul. And that's very much, of course, what's present in Descartes, where he's trying to sort of sequester the soul or the mind for philosophy and religion while leaving the rest of nature for science. So I think there are experiences that are strongly motivating of this way of thinking. I think there are also, it's tied very much to the rise of modern science, the idea that we want to, you know, as Galileo famously says, he says, you know, in order to read the book of nature, you know, the book that God has written, which is written in the language of mathematics, I'm going to, you know, remove all consciousness, all sentient beings, and characterize it purely in the quantitative language of geometry. So, you know, you remove the mind, and then you have this realm, this mathematically intelligible realm. So, I mean, that is part of the historical backstory as well. And other traditions didn't make that kind of cut. They made other kinds of cuts. They looked at things in other ways, even within, you know, the so-called Western tradition. Of course, there are always other voices and other ways of looking at things. And I mean, I think it's a philosopher's job to keep track of the different ways of looking at things, of the complexity of the terrain. Yeah.
And it sounds like a big part of navigating that complexity is looking at the multitude of different kinds of experiences we have and describing them and figuring out how to discriminate amongst them. When you're doing actual, doing your research and trying to connect that work up with, say, neuroscience, how does that actually work? Do you have an example of how you combine phenomenology and say neuroscience?
Yeah. Well, one example was a study that I participated in. Now it's almost about 10 years ago. With Kalina Kristoff, who's a neuroscientist here at University of British Columbia. She has a lab where she investigates spontaneous thought and spontaneous cognition. And the study, the lead investigator was Melissa Elamil. And what we did is we were interested in how thoughts arise spontaneously in, for example, what, you know, William James would call the stream of consciousness, the kind of ongoing flow of thought and feeling. And the usual way that this is approached and studied is you give people a very, very boring task and they inevitably get distracted and their mind wanders. And then you probe them and ask them, you know, was your mind wandering just now? Were you, if it was, were you aware of it or not aware of it? And then you try to, on the basis of what they report through these probes, you then try to look at the antecedent brain activity to see what's going on in the brain when someone goes off task and their mind wanders and they're either aware of it or they're not aware of it. So what we did is we worked with experienced meditators in a particular style of Buddhist meditation practice, where in this particular kind of practice, what you do is you practice a kind of open, non-selective awareness. And whenever you first feel a thought arising or you first notice a thought arising, you take note of that. You might label it, you know, like memory or feeling or image. You might give it a kind of minimal tag like that. And then you return, you sort of disengage from it or don't, as it were, stick to it, to use the sort of more experiential description, and let your mind return to a kind of just vigilant, watchful awareness. So we worked with individuals who were experienced long-term practitioners of this style of what's called Vipassana or insight meditation. And the idea was that their minds would, one, be more stable, two, be quieter, and three, they're trained to notice the subjective experience of a thought arising, so they'd be faster at reporting it. And On the basis of their reports with controls, we then looked at the antecedent neural activities. So the idea behind the arising of a spontaneous thought, this was using functional magnetic resonance imaging. So the idea was that with these kinds of individuals, they have a certain skill, and that skill enables you to tap into neural processes that you wouldn't see in someone who didn't have that skill, and then you can compare them against the individuals who don't have this kind of skill. And I mean, to make a long story short, we were able to trace the antecedent neural activity to parahippocampal areas involved in memory processes generally, but particularly memory, you could say, consolidation and retrieval and generation. We were able to get a portrait of activity in those areas that you don't see in individuals who you don't see as pronounced in individuals who don't have that kind of skill. So that's just it's a very limited example in one way, but it's a way that you can work with individuals who have a kind of phenomenological training in attention, internal attention, and awareness, to bring out information in neural activity that you wouldn't see otherwise, that might even be treated as noise for that matter, if you didn't have that way of tapping into it. So that's an example of what my colleague and former mentor, Francisco Varela, who was a neuroscientist, neurobiologist, an example of what he called neurophenomenology, of bringing neuroscience and phenomenology into a kind of active collaboration.
Well, thank you very much, Evan, for taking the time to talk with me. I thought, that was fascinating, and I'm really, really grateful to have been able to learn a bit more about what you're working on.
No, thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. I'm grateful to everyone at ICE at Dartmouth and to Evan Thompson for making this episode possible. We listen to The Wonder of Science by Lexan Music. Stay tuned for more episodes or check ice.dartmouth.edu. Thank you.